Lau.
Thank you.
Getting the last name right is a good first step. Good morning. My name is Travis Stearns. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Lau, and I'm going to ask for 3 minutes in reserve.
Very well.
So I know we raised and wrote about a number of issues, and I think that a lot of them have a lot of merit to them. I'm going to concentrate on a couple of them that I think just warrant more discussion. One is the question of volitional control, and the second is the question of future dangerousness. Because these are two, I think, fundamental due process issues that really, really do require more discussion and really a thought. And I want to start by saying the most obvious thing, that Mr. Lau is a violent person. Mr. Lau spent his life inside and outside of the institutions doing violent acts. The underlying offense which qualifies him for commitment is a very, very serious act. And in 1996, he clearly committed what could easily be characterized as another sexually aggressive act while he was in custody. And then there are 100 violations, serious violations while he's in the Department of Corrections, and an assault while he's at the SCC. So there's no question that this is a violent man, and that his history up until he starts working on his native issues demonstrates the violence. What this record does not have, and what his record, despite being in...
until he's working on his native issues?
Well, so he has... His return to the SEC is actually very interesting because he does stop committing the violent acts, and once he's back in the SEC... And I don't think that I probably should have not discussed that, because I don't think it's really relevant to the question of whether he is a sexually violent person. But there is evidence towards the end of his time in this record that he has worked on improving his propensity towards committing violence. And you may note from the record also that he's moved into less restrictive housing, that he's working with his counselor, and that there aren't these constant violent acts that occurred while he was in the Department of Corrections. But again, just as importantly as the question of whether Mr. Lau is violent or not is the conclusion that Dr. Packard, the state's expert, comes up with, which is that this is a willful choice on Mr. Lau's part, that he chooses to use violence to get his way. Now, RCW 7109 is only constitutional. It only passes the due process test if it is from a lack of volitional control. And over again, we see in the record of Dr. Packard's testimony, not the defense experts, but Dr. Packard's testimony, that this is a willful choice on Mr. Lau's part. Now, that is completely consistent with the diagnosis that he comes up with. The diagnosis is that Mr. Lau suffers from antisocial personality disorder, that there is post-traumatic stress syndrome from things that have occurred in his life, and that there is in historical evidence of chemical dependency. Now, again, historical evidence because in the...
doesn't he say that that is the mental abnormality, is that you have the personality disorder plus coupled with these other disorders that act as disinhibitors, which reduces the level of volitional control?
Again...
I guess I'm just questioning whether you're accurate in absolutely characterizing Dr. Packard's testimony as saying he always acts volitionally.
Again, I think that Dr. Packard's testimony is supported by the evidence of his history of acting volitionally to get his way by using violence. And I don't think that it's just Dr. Packard's testimony, but the decades of evidence that we have, him being under almost, I think, in IMU almost the entire time, or intensive management, almost the entire time that he was in the Department of Corrections, that we can see from this that he is making these choices. And frankly, the assault that he committed at the department or at the SEC is also that same sort of, I don't like where I am, I think that I'm in the wrong place, and I'm using violence to move myself. It demonstrates as well the same conclusions that I think that Dr. Packard comes up with. And again,
isn't that sort of a jury issue? And I mean, the jury heard expert testimony, and the at least part of the testimony was he suffers from PTSD and has suggested it renders his ability to control his actions somewhat, lessens that. The jury heard that testimony from both experts and it chose to credit Dr. Packard, thank you, and credited Dr. Packard's testimony.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a due process issue. I think that we have to get over that threshold first. I don't think that the evidence that establishes that is here, and again, you know,
the evidence is just insufficient to sustain that finding.
It is a sufficiency argument, but because I think that it's also a due process argument, it goes beyond sort of, and I'm not trying to weigh it at all or say that I do think that the ultimate question really is, was this the conclusions that the doctor came up with, do they support this lack of volitional control? And here again, I don't see that there is that lack of volitional control.
Well, what in your opinion is a case where lack of volitional control is demonstrated by the evidence? Because it sounds to me like you're saying that as long as someone chooses to act in a certain way, they can't be a sexually violent predator under the definition of the statute.
Well, no, absolutely not. I think that where you actually had a diagnosis of any type of a paraphilia, we've seen many cases upheld there where there is evidence of a continued sexual aggression, those would also be upheld. There are very few cases where the primary...
Well, wouldn't you be arguing if you had that kind of a client that, yes, it's true that they have this pattern of obsession, perverted sexual obsession, but they always choose volitionally the acts that are going to allow them to carry out that obsession?
Well, if I had that record, yes. I don't know if I would have that record in that type of a case. The record here, I think, supports the willful decision to create these acts. The last 40 seconds that I'm going to just touch on briefly is this future sexual violence. I think that the other critical issue here is whether or not the evidence actually supports the likelihood to commit a future sexually violent act as opposed to a violent act. And again, the evidence is supportive of this, of that there's a likelihood of a future violent act. The VRAG test is not a test designed to show sexual violent acts. The evidence, the clinical judgment without the actuarial support, I believe, does not support that. And I think that that's the second true issue or critical issue to look at.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Andrea Vitalich from the King County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the respondent, the State of Washington. We'd ask this Court to affirm, and I will jump right into the issues of volitional control and future dangerousness. I would note that specifically the statute doesn't, or the definition of being a sexually violent predator doesn't just encompass impairment of volitional control, but also impairment of emotional control. I would note for the record that it seems that Mr. Lau is concentrating on isolated portions of Dr. Packard's testimony where he talks about the DSM criteria for antisocial personality disorder involving a willingness or tendency towards committing crimes against other people and breaking down the barriers and not recognizing, you know, the human impact of their behaviors on others. However, I would draw the Court's attention most specifically to Dr. Packard's testimony in the morning of January the 27th, pages 74 and 75, where he talks about that if somebody, and he's talking about somebody like Mr. Lau, is stimulated if they have an associated, a particular trigger or set of triggers. Perhaps a person rejects them, and then he talks about that's what happened with J.I., and rejected him, and then that resulted in the anger and outpouring of the emotion and the rage, and then that became expressed in the violent rape and assault of J.I., and then the subsequent mutilation taking place in a way that was automatic as the result of the trigger. And then Dr. Packard continues talking about how that's exactly what happened as well at the SEC with the attack on Mr. Titus.
Doesn't that suggest, though, that the trigger that causes this non-volitional act or uncontrollable response it's a violent response. Why is that necessarily limited to sex offenses?
Well, it's not. But as Dr. Packard further testified, the important thing to note about Mr. Lau is that essentially if that trigger of that emotional response, or that he called it a catathymic rage response, if the trigger of that response is a man, it's likely to end up in a situation like what occurred with Mr. Titus. But if that trigger is a woman, that it's more likely to end up being a sexually violent offense. And obviously what occurred with GAI is perhaps the most extreme example of that that one can imagine. Dr. Packard also was very clear in his testimony that in his 30 years of doing this kind of work, Mr. Lau is a unique individual. And that because he considered Mr. Lau's profile to be that of a person who commits a sexual homicide, that this is not typically the kind of person that we would see in an SVP proceeding. This is typically the kind of person that who would be in prison for the rest of their life. So it's that uniqueness that Dr. Packard testified about. He said this is a person who has a unique psychological profile that doesn't fit neatly within the little boxes and categories as set forth in the DSM. And he talked about the catathymic rage response. He talked about the high psychopathy and all of he talked about the neurological issues that Mr. Lau was likely suffering when he talked about that with counsel on cross-examination.
So is it sufficient then that the only what makes him likely to commit a sexually violent offense is that if he happens to get triggered by a person who's a woman, then it's sexually violent?
Well, I think
but other than that, there's really no other diagnosis that suggests that he is going to commit a sexually violent offense.
Well, I think the short answer is yes, but I would also say that furthermore, the record reveals that there's quite a bit more to it than that. There was quite a history that was put forth before the jury at the trial about Mr. Lau's earlier experiences with sexually deviant behavior that wasn't necessarily outwardly violent in the same manner that the attack on J.I. was. We're talking about a 6-week trial, and Dr. Packard alone was on the stand for something on the order of 5 days, if I'm remembering correctly. There's a lot to this testimony, so trying to distill it to a couple of sound bites is extremely difficult. Certainly, Dr. Packard focused on the attack on J.I. and the catathymic rage response in terms of why he believes that Mr. Lau is more likely than not to reoffend in a sexually violent manner in the future. But there was certainly more to it than that. There was this is a person with a very complex history. It was undisputed at trial that he was subjected to a lot of trauma, violence, and was exposed to sexually deviant behavior in his childhood. Even defense counsel with Dr. Packard established that resulted in neurological changes in Mr. Lau's brain that affects his executive functioning. That also goes into the calculus of his likelihood to reoffend in the future and whether he has a lack of volitional and emotional control. So to argue that the evidence that the state produced, both of the likelihood of, well, the lack of volitional or emotional control and the likelihood of future sexually violent reoffense being insufficient under the test for insufficiency of the evidence, which applies in these cases, is really a stretch given the amount of evidence that was produced. And I would agree with counsel that the test for sufficiency of the evidence is grounded in due process. We know that from Winship. But it's not a freestanding sort of analysis apart from the Winship analysis that this court engages in. It asks, would a reasonable trier of fact, having all of this evidence before it and drawing all of the inferences in favor of the jury's verdict, was the evidence sufficient to sustain that verdict?
How was this argued to the jury? I mean, it's difficult to talk about these kinds of cases, certainly on appeal, without feeling that you're just talking about some pretty academic kind of psychological concepts. I mean, how is this presented? Once the 6-week trial was over and counsel on both sides figured that they'd gotten down to it, you know, with all of the testimony, what was the issue? How was it presented to the jury? What were they invited to think about and decide on the basis of? I mean, in other words, what was the argument made by counsel for Mr. Lau? Look, you don't have any proof that he was sexually violent.
Absolutely. This case was presented by the defense, essentially conceding, as counsel has today, that Mr. Lau is a violent person and that he may very well commit future acts of violence, but not acts of sexual violence. That was absolutely an argument that was made to the jury by defense counsel.
He might commit future sexual acts of violence, but not because he's the mental disorder causes that. It's because the person who he happens to be interacting with is a woman. Is that?
But that's as the result of a mental abnormality that causes the lack of emotional and volitional control that then leads to the acts that would constitute future acts of sexual violence. It was also argued strenuously, and of course Dr. Packard again was on the stand for something on the order of 5 days, and the cross-examination was extensive, about questioning Dr. Packard's diagnoses and judgments as far as what aspects of Mr. Lau's psychological profile comprise the mental abnormality as defined by the statute. So, of course, that was also a focus.
Well, one of the underlying themes on appeal is, what distinguishes a sexual predator, as Mr. Lau is alleged to be, from someone who's simply a recidivist, someone who commits crimes, commits one rape, commits another rape, and if he gets out, he's probably going to commit another one. What's the difference? I mean, obviously, that's a line.
Well, the difference would be, I think this was what Dr. First was trying to present, although even Dr. First agreed with me in cross-examination that Mr. Lau exhibits an uncontrollable rage response that is not necessary to a finding of antisocial personality disorder. The difference being that Mr. Lau's specific constellation of issues that comprise his mental abnormality causes him to have impaired volitional and emotional control that then leads to his sexual reoffending. And I would agree with counsel that if all we had was someone who was making a willful decision to commit a rape, that would not constitute being a sexually violent predator. But what we have here is very, very different, and that is supported by the evidence.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The most challenging question, I think, was one of the last ones that you asked, is how do you distinguish between the predator and the person who chooses to commit these crimes? And it is a struggle, I think, that the Supreme Court has had and every court in between, because it is a fundamental question of due process. And the only way that this statute remains constitutional is it is clearly limited to someone who lacks the control to commit these crimes. And that is just not the case here. And I know I concentrated on his profile, but throughout the evidence here, this is a man who chooses to commit these acts. We talk about the unique psychological profile, but it is only unique to the SCC. It is not unique to the population of people who are housed within the Department of Corrections. We know that the folks who are incarcerated suffer greatly from these same psychological profiles that the state was able to show that Mr. Lau suffered from. Antisocial personality disorder may inflict 70-80% of the people that are within the Department of Corrections. Psychopathy is far higher.
Those figures all in the record?
I think that those are all in the record. Those are not, I think, I may be wrong on the exact numbers, but those are
something like that.
Yeah, those are the antisocial personality disorder is commonly diagnosed against people who are within the Department of Corrections.
Who was the witness that testified about that?
You know, I don't know if it was within a witness's testimony. It may have been Dr. Abbott, or, again, it may have just been other material that was submitted to the court, and I apologize for not remembering that. But it is not an uncommon diagnosis for folks. And again, as Ms. Itilich, observed while she was talking to you as well, that this is someone who the doctor would have expected to see remaining within the Department of Corrections and not at the SEC. So you come to the end of his sentence term, and then you say, what do we do? The evidence here does not support the due process requirement that this has to be a person who, because of his mental disorder, lacks the control to commit these crimes. And his decision to commit these crimes and the evidence which supports that it is his volitional or his decision to commit violent crimes and not sexually violent crimes runs afoul of our due process requirements, and which is why I think that this is really the fundamental question that you have to answer before finding that this was a constitutional case, and I would say that it is not. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.